This is MSO News Sports, a special Friday feature here on the website. Congressman Seth Moulton's telephone town hall. It was held earlier today. We join that town hall with Congressman Seth Moulton's opening statement, and then that will be followed by telephone calls from constituents.
Apply for unemployment and advocating for patients in the VA and other medical systems. This week alone, we've responded to more than 3,500 letters, phone calls, and emails just this week. And we've opened several individual cases for people who have been laid off and businesses that are struggling. Over the last week, we got the sad news that Vitalina Williams, who works at the Market Basket in Salem and Walmart in Lynn, died after contracting COVID-19 because she didn't have the PPE that she needs. So I wrote a letter to the governor asking him to designate grocery store workers and other essential employees as emergency responders so they could have priority testing and PPE. The next day, he gave these workers access to priority testing. Nobody should die at work in the richest country on earth because they don't have the simple protective equipment necessary to do their job safely. And that brings us to today, where we are nearly 2 months on and still lacking the testing we need to figure out who has COVID-19. Frontline workers, heroes who lack PPE, especially those nurses and doctors who are saving lives every single day at great risk to their own. And that's a direct result of the failures of our commander-in-chief. We received news within the last week the president was warned about the potential for a pandemic in November when the intelligence community started putting it in the presidential daily brief. We should have been stockpiling protective equipment, building more ventilators, and developing a test kit that worked. But instead, the president and his team have downplayed the virus. So we have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of work to make sure that we're using the instruments of the federal government to mobilize America to defeat this threat. We have a lot of work to do to make sure we can restart the economy and get Americans back to work, but only when it is safe to do so. And we have a lot of work to do in the meantime to support small businesses, to support those frontline workers, the people who are going to work every single day to keep us safe, to support this huge number of people who have been laid off in just the last several months. We have a lot of work to do, a lot of work ahead of us, but I can't do my job very well if I don't hear from all of you, the people that I represent. So I'm delighted to be here on the call with you this morning. Thank you so much for joining me, and I look forward to taking your questions. Tim, back over to you.
Great. Remember, if you have a question and you just joined us, you can press *3 at any time to get in line. And now through the line, get to as many questions as we can here in the time that we have. If you hear your name after I call it out, you're live and on the air. Again, *3 to ask a question. Our first question today comes from Karen. Karen, you are live.
Oh, hi. Thank you holding. Hi. Thank you for holding this meeting. Never done this before. I was curious about how likely the public schools will be open in September, and also if they are open, will students and staff have to wear PPE masks as well?
Well, Karen, these are great questions, and I'll be totally honest with you, we really don't know the answer. Whether or not schools open in September is really dependent on what we do between now and then to stop the spread of this virus or slow down the spread of the virus, and then whether or not we have the treatments and other things necessary in place to make sure that we can safely reopen. I think that there's a good chance that we will see us get through the peak in the next month or so, and perhaps the virus numbers will go down over the summer if we continue adhering to the procedures and policies that we've put in place. But there's also a great risk that if we reopen the country too early, if we send everybody back to work, kids back to school, although, I mean, I know the school year is almost over, if we do things like that too quickly, then the virus could have a resurgence. There's also a fear among epidemiologists that the virus could simply have a resurgence in the fall with cold weather, the way that the flu does. We don't know if that's true about this particular virus, but there's a lot of evidence to suggest it might be the case. So what we need to do in the meantime is, first of all, get way more testing. We need to make sure that we know across the board who has this, and therefore that, and make sure that they can take measures to keep themselves safe and keep their loved ones safe. Part of that is doing this contact tracing effort that the state of Massachusetts is pioneering with Partners in Health, with Dr. Paul Farmer. It's a technique that's been used in many other parts of the world, but has not been used much here in the United States, at least not on this kind of scale. And the way it works is that if you are identified as someone who has this virus, there will be ways through technology that we can trace who you've been in contact with, contact them, and make sure they're quarantining themselves so they don't spread it further. One of the biggest challenges with this new coronavirus is that it spreads so easily, and it spreads asymptomatically. So you might have it, be spreading it to all the people that you meet, but never develop any symptoms yourself. That makes it very hard to stop. So whether or not we can reopen schools in the fall, how soon we can open businesses, it's dependent on the kind of work that we do right now. We've got to continue doing the social distancing effectively so that we can get through the peak, but then we've got to be very careful about how we open up and make sure that we have widespread testing and effective contact tracing in place to curtail the spread of this virus even as we go back to work. So I hope that answers your question, Karen. I'm going to be always honest with you when I know the answer and when I don't. In this case, I don't think anyone knows the answer as to whether schools will be open in the fall or not, although we certainly hope that they will be.
All right. Remember, if you have a question, you can press star 3. Our next question comes from Leonard. Leonard, you're live on the air.
Hello, Congressman. How are you?
I'm good, Leonard. How are you? Thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm recovering from a severe stroke of 10 years ago, and some of the symptoms seem to emulate what this virus is doing, but my doctor refuses to see me at the Leahy Clinic. He says, I can tell by your voice you don't have the virus. That's amazing. He should be on the team of doctors. You can tell by my voice. I don't know what the exact symptoms are, but my wife also works at a Market Basket in another town. And my question is, where's the mandatory testing at this station? Where? It's not. She also goes to a clinic, Lynn Community Hospital, which is funded by the federal government and the state government. And they're trying to charge her for mammograms. They don't even give her a test. They sent her a bill for $1,000. This is ridiculous. It's stupid, ridiculous, and it's full of bureaucrats over there. Regular paycheck. That's all. Do any work? Forget it. Paperwork. They held up treatment of her for 2 months because they wanted to see my insurance cash value on my life insurance. 2 months for a document. I don't call that good government.
Leonard, I wouldn't call it good government either. And I appreciate you sharing that story with me and with everybody on the line because the fact of the matter is that our healthcare system is not up to task. And it is not doing the job that it should. I believe that healthcare is a human right. I believe that everybody in America, regardless of how rich or poor you are, deserves access to the best healthcare in the world because we have the best healthcare in the world here. We ought to make sure that we live up to our foundational values as a country, that everybody has the same opportunity to get it. We're fighting hard in Congress to make that a reality. There's a lot of debate in the Democratic Party about exactly how to get there, whether it's through a Medicare for All program or it's through more of a public option program that allows you to keep your private insurance if you want to, which is the route that I prefer. But the reality is that that there's a lot of work to do, and there's a lot of opposition from members of the opposite party to expanding healthcare access in this country. And it's one of the problems that we're one of the reasons why we're not very well equipped to handle this pandemic. You know, we've been investing in a lot of things over the country of the last 10 years in this country, We just gave a massive tax cut to corporations and to the wealthy. That tax cut cost about $1.9 trillion. That's how much the Trump tax cut expanded the deficit. It's interesting that right now the legislation that we've passed to just simply bail out people for the coronavirus is about $1.8 trillion. So we would actually have been able to cover that if we hadn't given this massive tax cut. But the point is that we need to invest a lot more in people's health. And we need to do a lot more to make sure that people like you and your wife can feel well taken care of by our government. There's no question that we don't have enough testing yet. I wrote the vice president about a month and a half ago, saying that we need more testing, and we still have not delivered. We need to make sure that we have more PPE. That's why I advocated for you and your wife, for everybody who works at grocery stores, because we need you. We need you on the job to get the rest of us through this crisis. You're doing essential work. And frankly, you're heroes for showing up at work every single day. It's just like the transit workers, the people who are, you know, the conductors and engineers and the commuter rail, the motormen on the subways, all those people who are working to make sure that we can still function as a country every single day while putting yourselves at risk. You're heroes. And we should treat you like that, not treat you like the way you've described. I want you to know that we are here to help you however we can. And if you can't get the help that you deserve through your normal channels, you can always call my office for help. If you don't know it, my office number is 978-531-1669. You can find that on my website, molten.house.gov. You can go to my Facebook page, or find me on other social media. But again, don't be shy about giving me a call, 978-531-1669. We have a fabulous, literally award-winning casework team that will be happy to help you out and try to get you the help that you deserve. So thanks very much for sharing your story. I'm terribly sorry that you're going through this right now. It's not right. It's not American. And we do need to do a lot of work to fix it.
All right. Remember, if you have a question, you can press *3 to get in line. Our next question comes from Michael, who I believe lives in Newbury. Michael, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a small business owner, and I fortunately was able to get a loan through the PPP program yesterday. Unfortunately, the money's run out, and a lot of my friends that are small businesses did not get the loan. Why do we have to wait for Congress to come back in 2.5 weeks before they can even consider, adding more money to the mix? And, it's really unfortunate. We're in a crisis. You guys shouldn't be out on vacation at this point.
Well, Michael, we're very much not on vacation, I can assure you that. My team and I are putting in extraordinary hours. We've been working remotely for since the very beginning now. And we're actually taking many more cases, many more calls, many more emails than we do on a regular basis. In fact, I asked my team this morning to put up some of the statistics on that so you know. But in general, it's about twice as much. So literally my team is working twice as hard. We're just working remotely. I want you to know that first. In terms of Congress as a whole, though, there's no question that we were unprepared for this. And I've been advocating from the very beginning when we were first briefed that we need to be prepared to work remotely as a Congress, because it's very likely that we would have to be out of session to prevent the spread of this virus. Far from being on vacation, we're working hard in our districts, but more importantly, we're preventing the spread of this virus by not meeting in person. But that doesn't mean that Congress shouldn't be doing its job. And that's where I agree with you. There's no reason why we have to go back in session formally in Washington, in person, in other words, in order to pass more relief for small businesses. The current opposition to that is the Republican Senate. We've been advocating the Democratic House for more relief, and there are a lot of Republicans in the House who've been advocating for this as well. But Republicans in the Senate are opposed to providing more relief right now. So that's the political problem that we're in at the moment. But I'm fully supportive of it. I know that SBA loans have run out. I'm talking to constituents like yourself every single day. who have applied to loans. Some of them haven't gotten the loan, haven't even gotten through yet. So you're fortunate to have gotten through. But we have a lot more work to do and a lot more money to pass to meet the demand. As you said, the money recently ran out, and there are an awful lot of businesses that haven't even gotten through the pipeline yet. Yeah. We love small businesses, especially here in this district, but that means we have to actually show up to support you more. Just in this past week, my office answered 3,500 letters. Many of them are about unemployment or access to the SBA programs. We did a town hall with the SBA administrator a couple weeks ago for Massachusetts to understand, to tell people how to properly apply for these programs and make sure you can get the loan that you need. The Paycheck Protection Program is another really important feature of the CARES Act that I want you to be aware of. The stimulus includes nearly $350 billion in funding for a provision to create a Paycheck Protection Program that would provide small businesses and other entities with zero-fee loans up to $10 million. The idea here is it's meant to cover 8 weeks of average payroll, benefit, rent, utilities, and interest and any other debt obligations incurred over this period that will be forgiven if the business retains its employees at their salary level. So the idea is that small businesses can keep paying the rent, keep paying benefits, keep paying their employees, most importantly, actually keep people on the payroll. The federal government will help cover those costs, and then you'll be all ready to go back to work when you're able to open up again. Let me just finally close by making sure you understand what my priorities are for any supplemental legislation to the CARES Act or a subsequent piece of legislation that we certainly should be passing right away. Number one, we've got to support healthcare workers, the nurses and doctors on the front lines. Number two, we've got to support workers and their families. I know so many people who've already lost their jobs. Number three, we've got to support small businesses just like your own. And one of the most important features of the CARES Act is the amount of money that goes to grants for small businesses, not loans that you have to pay back. And then only after those top three priorities should we talk about any industry bailouts, and those should be in the form of loans, not grants. We need to make sure that the large industries that frankly have the financial wherewithal to weather this crisis will pay back the American taxpayer for any money that we loan them. So thanks very much for asking your question and giving me the opportunity to talk about the work that my team and I are doing every single day. We're working remotely, but we are doing an awful lot for our constituents. I wish I could say the same about Congress as a whole, because although we're working remotely, we're not working as well as a Congress, because the Congress has not been set up to
get in line. Our next question comes from David in Beverly. David, you're on the air.
Hey, Congressman, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, hi, David. How are you?
I'm still standing. Thanks for asking. I'm a self-employed employee. I own a small limo company. I'm owner-operator. I have one vehicle. And I haven't been able to apply for unemployment yet because I'm a gig worker. And the governor keeps saying it's coming, it's coming. And, you know, so it wasn't Christmas. I was wondering if you had any insight on where we are in the process, and when can I start getting benefits? Because I've been out of work actually since the middle of February, so this is going on 8 or 9 weeks now without a paycheck, no clients, and all the hotels are closed. No one's flying. My line of work doesn't look like it's going to come back. So I'm kind of in the hole a little bit deeper than the guy that works at a construction company, or a restaurant, or a bartender. So if you could give me a little insight and hopefully a little inspiration, I'd appreciate an answer. Thank you.
Absolutely, David. Well, first of all, I just want to thank you for sharing that story, because this is a story I've heard a lot. You're not alone. I'm going to be honest with you, too. The response has been way too slow here. So there are a lot of people in your shoes, and for all of you, frankly, the government's letting you down, because we should be able to respond more quickly to your needs. Let me talk a little bit about just the system so you and anyone else who's in this same boat can know exactly how this should work and how you apply for support. The portal to submit a self-employment claim is not available yet, but it will be by April 30th. Now, April 30th is still 2 weeks away. I get the fact that that's ridiculous. It's too late. I'm with you there. It's a portal that's run by the state, so self-employed workers can apply when the state opens this program. As you know, I don't have any direct control over what the state does, but I do know that they're working hard on getting this set up. That's all also why we tried to get stimulus money, directly for people like you. If you're able to get through and have already submitted a claim as a self-employed worker before the portal is set up to allow you to file, your claim will likely be denied. So really wait for this to be announced, because unfortunately, if that happens, you'll have to reapply. Self-unemployed individuals can, however, access unemployment benefits, and you deserve to receive those benefits during this challenging time as much as anyone. So if you have any further questions about that, please reach out to the state's Department of Unemployment Assistance. Their number is 877-626-6800. Again, 877-626-6800. And call us, too, if you can't get through, because we can open a case for you. Don't be afraid to ask for our help if it's if we can assist. So again, the state unemployment assistance number is 877-626-6800. You mentioned that your business is tourism based, and look, I mean, let's be honest, reopening is going to be tough for tourism locations, you know, for anchor locations like the aquarium, which is a nonprofit and a big draw for events and for your business. I introduced the Save Organizations That Serve America Act, a nonprofit relief bill, so that places like museums and aquariums and other anchors of our nonprofit community are able to stay open and keep drawing visitors here when it's safe to do so. So I do not believe that that you don't have a future. I think you do have a future in this industry, but there's no question that we've got to get on top of the pandemic first. And when people feel that it's safe to go back to work and to continue traveling and all that, I think people will do that. I know that there will be a post-coronavirus world or a post-COVID world that's a little bit different than the world that we know now. There may be more telework. You might be able to do things much more conveniently from home in certain instances. But I know people are still going to want to travel. I know that there's still a lot of value in being able to meet folks in person for business meetings. I know that people are still going to want to visit their families. In fact, there's going to be a real pent-up demand for people wanting to visit their families and do business travel once it's safe to do so, because we've all been prevented from doing that for a while. So I think you have a future, and I think actually there's a point at which the future could be quite bright once we open the floodgates to tourism because it's safe to do so. We're obviously not there yet, though, and we've got to help you weather the storm in the meantime. That's what we've got to do. We're doing it, but we need to do more. And I'm not afraid to admit that. We also need to do it more quickly. So thank you for what you're doing and your patience and whatnot. And David, thanks for sharing your story with others on the call, because I know there are other people who need this information as well.
Okay, remember, if you have a question, you can press *3 to get in line. The next question comes from Edward. Edward, you're on the air.
Hi, Edward.
Hello. Hi.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
This is doing Ted well. From Byfield. Thank you. Thanks for
Edward. Yep, Edward. I go by Ted from Byfield. My question is about the post office. The White House has announced they will not support aid to the post office in the next aid bill. Based on what the Republicans attempted in the recent election in Wisconsin, it's clear they intend to suppress votes in November. And it's more than obvious that as part of this, they're trying to weaken the post office to make it harder to vote by mail. What are the Democrats doing to ensure that we continue to have a strong, functioning post office in the next aid bill?
Ted, thanks very much for that question. This is an emergency, and Postal Service is vital right now, and it's running out of money. I mean, frankly, when you can't go to the store, you can't go shopping for goods themselves, a lot of people are turning to delivery to rely on just being able to get through the day. And so we need to make sure the post office is supported. If the post office suddenly stops functioning, we're going to have real big problems here in America. So I'm a co-sponsor of H.R. 6425. That's the bill number for a bill called the Protect Our Post Services Act. It would appropriate $25 billion to the U.S. Postal Service to keep it open and to give it to give us time to fix its underlying financial problems. Look, I'm not someone who thinks that the U.S. Postal Service is a perfectly run business. I do know that they have gotten a lot better over recent years, and we need to continue to support their improvement while we also simply keep them in business because they provide an essential function for our country. You know, there are other private companies like FedEx and UPS that do package delivery. They compete with the Postal Service, and frankly, that's good. It keeps prices down for everybody. In fact, if the Postal Service went out of business, you could see your package delivery prices go up for the other carriers because there'd be less competition in the market. But there's no competition in the market for just everyday mail delivery. That's an essential service provided by the federal government that needs to be maintained. And it doesn't matter how rich or poor you are, whether you're a big business or you have a little mailbox at the end of a dirt road, you need to be able to get postal service, and you need to be able to have that 6 days a week. So I support that. Democrats in Congress support it. And, you know, your point about voting by mail is really important as well, because if there's one thing we've learned from this virus, it's that we've got to be smarter about how we just function as a democracy. And just as we've got to be better in Congress at working remotely, at doing the work to support small businesses and people who are out of work, like some of the callers we've heard from this morning, we've got to be able to do that remotely. You've got to be able to vote remotely, too. And there are several states that have implemented vote by mail already. They've been very effective. It's a very effective program. It's safe. It's secure. And there's no reason why it shouldn't be expanded to every state in the country. We should be working as a government to get more people involved in our democracy, to allow more voices to be heard, not suppressing voices because people can't make it to a polling station. So there is a big contrast here between a president who literally says that he does not want vote for mail because it will hurt his reelection chances, and people like myself who are saying, I just want more people to vote. And you know what? I don't know if they're going to vote for me or vote for my opponents. I'm going to try to earn their votes. But the bottom line is that every voice should be heard in the democracy. That should be the founding principle that we all agree on. So thank you for your question. Know that I'm with you. I'm supporting you. I support vote by mail. And I also support making sure the Postal Service stays in business.
Okay, remember, if you have a question, you can press star 3 to ask it. Our next question comes from Joe. Joe, you are live.
Oh, thank you for putting me on, and thank you for holding the webinar. My question was, I read in the newspaper we were going to receive the $1,200 if we were qualified for, but I haven't heard. There's a lot of people. A lot of my friends haven't received it, and I haven't received it. Do you know what's holding that back?
Yeah, Joe, thank you very much for your question. Sadly, I do know what's holding it back. The president decided that he wants his name on the check that you get in the mail, and that's going to delay it about 3 weeks. It's unbelievable. He's putting his ego ahead of getting money to you so that you can put food on the table. But that's a simple fact. That's what he's doing. Every check, just like a dollar bill or whatever, put out by the federal government is usually signed by the Secretary of the Treasury. But for the first time in American history, this president wants to have his signature on the check, and it's causing a three-week delay in getting them to people like you. So that's what's going on here. It's pure egotistical politics on behalf of the president. And it's not partisan of me to say that. It's just simple facts. That's what he's doing. Now, how you'll get your stimulus money depends on how you received your last tax return. So if it was sent electronically, you'll get a direct deposit, and that will come sooner. But if it was by paper, it will be by check. My newsletter that is going out right now has information on how to update your address if you recently moved. So make sure you do that. Check out my newsletter. If you're not getting my email newsletter, make sure you go to moulton.house.gov. That's moulton.house.gov. to sign up to receive that email so you can get this critical information, because obviously we certainly don't want your check going to an old address. You should also know that the formula for how much you receive depends on how much you normally earn. So every American who reported making $75,000 or less as an individual or $150,000 or less for married couples filing joint returns will receive $1,200. If you made more than that, the payment amount goes down by $5 for each $100 above the $75,000, $150,000 threshold. So you can also check your eligibility status of receiving a check on IRS.gov, and I'll show you the chart there so you can get an idea of exactly how big that check should be when it comes in the mail. So thanks very much for asking that question. I know that there are an awful lot of other people who are wondering the same thing.
Okay, our next question comes from Bruce. Bruce, you are on the air.
Good morning, Congressman Moulton. It's nice to encounter you. I have heard you speak at Temple Emmanuel in Marblehead. I'm a resident of Marblehead. I'm 80 years old, and my issue is a little less specific than the ones that you've been handling. I would like your thoughts on fear. As this begins to lift, whatever the time schedule, how do people like me, who are in the highest risk group, feel comfortable going back out into a world that will be very much changed, unfamiliar, perhaps dangerous at any moment? Will I flee from everyone who coughs? It could be an allergy. Will I never feel comfortable coming near people? Do you have any ideas about this? It's not really a congressional issue. It's more personal in your sense of how we will reintegrate into society.
Bruce, it's a great question. Thank you very much for offering it and sharing it. And I'm happy to comment on this because although I'm not an expert, I've tried to become one as much as possible, largely thanks to the really impressive scientific advisory panel that we've brought together to try to understand the ins and outs of this virus and the latest research. One point I just want to make briefly before I get into answering your question specifically is that we have a curated science page on our website. So if you go to moulton.house.gov, you'll find a link there to the coronavirus page. And every single day, usually a few times a day, our MIT science fellow updates the latest research about how this virus is progressing, what we understand about it, and obviously what we can do to combat it. So I encourage you to go there and check out the latest research. From all of the things that I've read and understand, here are a few things I would say. First of all, the number one thing we can do to abate your fear and make you feel comfortable going back to life as normal is to produce a vaccine. And obviously, there are a lot of companies, a lot of governments that are working on producing a vaccine. It's good that this is a worldwide problem from the perspective of pursuing a vaccine, because there are so many different folks competing to get it done quickly. And it's truly historic that in record time, vaccines have already been put into production and tested, or being tested, rather, on humans. Human trials are going on right now. Now, we won't know the results of those trials for some time. The trials have really two goals. One, to make sure the vaccine is effective. That's pretty obvious. But also to make sure the vaccine is safe. And we need to do trials before we start distributing the vaccine that even if it works, it might be not safe for people, and we certainly don't want to create more problems. But the biggest thing we can do to make sure that you can safely go back to life as normal is to have a vaccine. Now, since it's going to take some time to get that vaccine, and the time estimates vary, what can we do in the meantime? Well, one thing we can do is we can develop treatments. Most people think that we'll be able to develop effective treatments for this virus before we develop a vaccine. That means that if you do get it, worst case scenario, and you have to go to the hospital, we'll know what drugs actually work to treat it. Now, what the president has been saying about this one drug, hydrochloroquine, is not supported by science. It might prove to be effective, but it's far from conclusive right now. And that's an example of why we've got to make sure we do the studies and know that works. Frankly, if everybody who's being given hydrochloroquine is cured of the virus, then we'd know it works, but that's far from the case. It's clear that it is not a 100% effective treatment. Whether it's effective or not at all is still up for debate. But if we can get treatments that are effective, then you'll know that, worst case scenario, I get this virus. They know how to stop it from taking over my body. The other things that we can do are to to implement way more widespread testing so we can simply get on top of who actually has this virus and might be spreading it. What are we talking about? Well, look, my wife and I were diagnosed with symptoms of COVID-19 a few weeks ago. We had all the things you read about. I had chest tightness, a fever, body aches, pains, fatigue, and all of that. But we had relatively mild cases compared to folks who were in the hospital. Statistically, this is actually the most common way I get the virus, although most people have mild cases, not severe cases. But they said, we don't have enough tests to give you. So we couldn't get tested. Well, we should be testing not only people who have symptoms, but frankly, just a ton of people who don't, to just simply track where this virus is and how quickly it's spreading. And then we'll have a better idea of what we can do to stop it. Now, hand in hand with testing is what's called contact tracing, which means that if you go in for a test, maybe you don't even have symptoms, but you just say, look, I'm 80 years old. I'm in a high risk category. I want to be tested to make sure I catch this thing early if I've got it. And the test comes back and it says, yes, you've got it. You don't have any symptoms yet, but you already have the virus. So then we put you on a treatment protocol, but then we also track all the people that you've been in touch with recently. So if you've seen your son or daughter recently and their kids, then they will get alerted, hey, you know, grandpa has coronavirus. That means he might have given it to you, so we've got to be aware. It could go the other way, too. Imagine if you have grandkids and one of your grandkids has no symptoms because it doesn't affect young people that badly. Nonetheless, they get that granddaughter or grandson gives it to you. You've got to know that as soon as possible. So we can't do effective contact tracing unless we have truly widespread testing. I'm talking about testing where, you know, if you just feel like you might want to get tested, you can show up and get a test. That's where we should be as a country, and we're so far from it today. As I said earlier, I wrote a letter to the vice president way back in February asking for, demanding that we have much more widespread testing. Weeks later, over a month later, we're still not there. But if we get there, it can really help ease your anxiety. I have every confidence that we will get to a point where life returns to more or less as normal. That doesn't mean everything's exactly the same. I think that people will have some benefits coming out of this in the sense that they will be able to get telehealth appointments more readily. Some things that were not available or easy to do online will be things that you can now do from your home. But I also think that people are still going to want to travel. People are still going to want to see their relatives and friends. People are still going to want to go out to eat at restaurants. I know I certainly do. Ennis Cantor, the Boston Celtics, and I had a fun conversation last night on Facebook Live that you can see on my Facebook page, where we talked about some of the things that we want to do when this quarantine is safely over. We both agreed we want to get haircuts. So barbers who are all out of work right now, you're going to have a surge in business. We both agreed that we want to go back out to restaurants with our families. So that's something that will come back as well. But we are a ways away from that yet. And I know that there are an awful lot of people who are rightly concerned. So your question about fear is a great one, and I hope I at least provide a little help in trying to answer it.
Okay, we have a few more questions, time for a few more questions. Our next question comes from Marguerite from Newbury, and I'm sorry if I got your name wrong, Ms. Flanagan.
That is my name, Marguerite Flanagan. Thank you so much, Congressman, for holding this town hall and also for your great technology and informing of us of it so we could be ready and we could be here. Thank you for your service now
Marguerite,
and always.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Marguerite. Thanks so much for asking a question.
Yes, I have a quick one based on the fact that I'm quite surprised that with all the strength of the advice that we should be wearing masks particularly for the safety of others, that when I go in the grocery store, so many of the employees, the stores, especially where we buy food, employees are not wearing masks. And I'm wondering if there's any way that can be mandated even on the state level, which you may not be able to answer, but that's my question.
Well, the answer is yes. It certainly can be mandated. Because I'm not the governor, I can't make that mandate myself. But I completely agree with you that everyone should wear masks even if it's just a homemade one, because if you wear it in public, we know that you're going to reduce the spread of the virus. When you do the math around how a virus like this spreads, you need to just look at how likely it is to get transmitted. And we know that wearing a mask reduces the chances of getting it transmitted. It doesn't necessarily reduce it to absolute zero. There are still ways, like, you know, if you have, you're wearing a mask, but earlier you sneezed on your, or coughed on your hand and you didn't wash your hands properly, you could still transmit it. But the chances of transmitting it go way down, and that's what we need to do to limit the spread of this virus. So masks help a lot. And I couldn't agree more that if there's one group of people who we want to see wearing masks, it's our grocery store employees, because they're buying food from them. That's why I wrote a letter to Charlie Baker last week, asking him to designate grocery store workers as emergency personnel, which gets them priority access to PPE, to the personal protective equipment, not only masks, but also gloves, even gowns. And it also gives them priority access to testing, so that they can find out right away if they have the coronavirus and therefore obviously stop working. I've heard from constituents who work at grocery stores that they fear contracting the virus due to their increased but obviously unavoidable exposure to the public. You know, these employees face a difficult decision. They either leave their jobs to protect their own health and safety or show up to work so that we can all eat. I really admire those grocery store workers who are showing up to work every single day. We obviously got to make sure for their safety and for ours that they have the personal protective equipment that that we need. And just last Friday, right after I wrote the letter, the state announced that they will be providing priority testing to grocery store workers. So Governor Baker heard my request. He responded to it exactly as I asked him to. The problem, of course, is that we still don't have enough. So we need to fully exercise the Defense Production Act. In fact, yesterday I joined a Massachusetts delegation, a letter to the Department of Defense and the FEMA to make sure that we're using defense manufacturing capabilities to produce PPE like face masks, because we obviously don't have enough if you're still going to the grocery store and seeing people without them. What I would encourage you to do the next time you're at the grocery store is pull aside a manager and say, look, you know, this is for our safety, our public safety, that your employees have personal protective equipment. And if that manager says that he can't get it, have him call my office. We got to figure out how to make sure that grocery store workers who are on the front lines of this crisis in a sort of different way than the doctors and nurses, but are very much exposed to the public and exposed to the risk of the virus, we got to make sure that they're protected and that all of us can feel confident and safe in eating our food. So thank you very much for your question. And again, please do follow up with my office if you see anything that's not right. I went grocery shopping about a week ago. My wife and I really are trying to limit our trips so that we're not in the grocery store too often. But once a week we go and buy groceries for ourselves and also for my parents and for my Aunt Sheila down in Lynn, and so they don't have to go out. And when I went to the store, almost all the grocery store employees, and there was one I remember who wasn't, but almost all of them were wearing masks. But that's obviously not the case across the board. Thanks again for your question, Maria.
Okay, we have time for one or two more questions here. The next question comes from James. James, you're on the air.
Hi, James.
Hello. Hi. How are you? Hello.
I'm good. How are you? Thanks very much for joining us.
Hanging in there. I'm concerned about the ever increasing federal deficit, $30 trillion now, going to 35 or even more with all these payments. Curious your thoughts on where it's all going to come to end. And I'm 70 years old, and what's going to happen in the coming years? It doesn't seem like it could just keep going. No one ever seems to address that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the numbers you're referring to are the debt, not the deficit, but the deficits are getting worse. And so every single year we're sending out more money than we take in. And that has got dramatically worse under this administration because of the Trump tax cut, which was just unpaid for. So, you know, if you want to cut taxes, you got to be able to come up with the money somehow. And the administration has failed to do that. So as a result, we have a massive problem here. with a deficit that I see every single day because I sit on the budget committee. I'm actually the vice chairman of the budget committee, and frankly, the budget is not in good shape right now because of this tax cut that I voted against. The Congress passed and the president signed. To give you some numbers to think about, the CARES Act that we passed will increase federal deficits by about $1.8 trillion over 10 years. $1.8 trillion over 10 years. The bill costs more than that. It's a $2 trillion plus bill. But obviously some of that money will come back. Some of that money is in loans, not in grants. Some of that money will obviously increase economic activity. But the bottom line is it's going to result in $1.8 trillion additional deficit, over 10 years. And that's an important number to remember because this Republican tax cut added $1.9 trillion to federal deficits over 10 years. Giving these tax cuts to wealthy and large corporations. So look, everyone loves tax cuts, but the bottom line is that we can't afford them right now. And it's striking that $1.9 trillion tax cut would have actually covered the cost of our coronavirus outbreak with a little bit left over. So we got a lot of work to do here. I'm with you. We can't keep running up deficits because fundamentally, although, you know, look, the government can print money, and we might not see an immediate crisis from a slightly larger deficit in our lifetimes. We're just going to pass it on to our kids. We're going to pass it on to our grandkids. And that's not right. You know, you have sort of American dream of growing up and, you know, doing a little bit better than your parents and then passing some of that on to your children. And, you know, to put it in sort of a storybook form, it's like, you know, having a nice little house with a white picket fence to pass on to your kids. No one wants to pass on a little house with a white picket fence that's on fire. But that's essentially what we're doing when we hand these massive deficits over to the next generation. So I share your concern. There's immediate work that we need to do with legislation like the CARES Act to help us get through this disaster, but we do have to pay for it. And if we don't, we're just sending that bill to our kids and our grandkids, and that's not right.
Okay, this is our last question of the morning here, and it comes from Joanne. Joanne, you're on the air.
Hi, hello, Congressman Moulton. Thank you for taking my question. Hello, I'm okay. I'm going to try and make this last question short and sweet. It's pretty direct. Although we live in a lovely community like Marblehead, in this era of unemployment and insecurity, people need access to food. There are young families who need access to food. And it's difficult to get information on where the sites are that would be available. It seems that people have access town by town or city by city, and Marblehead doesn't seem to have anything. Is there a site or a way that we can get this information in our town specifically, please?
Thank you very much for your question because it is incredibly important. And I'll tell you, we've been tracking this closely as a team because we recognize that demand for food is going to go up as so many people are unemployed and they can't go and buy food themselves. They need to have access to food at food pantries. At the same time, food pantries are having trouble simply getting access to the product, getting food on their shelves. And a lot of that's because, you know, they're losing volunteers because people are scared to volunteer because of the virus, understandable concern. And so some of the folks that they usually rely on to show up for work every day aren't there. I'm going to, you know, give a few website. I just actually asked my team to just provide some contact information for some of the food pantries in the area. But we'll have more information on my website. So again, I want to remind people, moulton.house.gov, moulton.house.gov. This is a place where you can go for all kinds of information on the coronavirus and the response. But let me just give folks, I mean, I know that we have people from all over the district, who are listening to the call. So let me just run through a few of the options. Starting out in the far western part of the district with the Bedford Food Pantry, 12 Mudge Way in Bedford, is open Thursday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. Beverly Bootstraps is a great pantry, 35 Park Street in Beverly. That's open Monday, Thursday, and Friday, 10 to 2. Tuesday, 2 to 6. Wednesday, 10 to 6. The Open Door Pantry in Gloucester is open from Monday through Friday, 10 to 5. And you can contact them by phone or email. You can find all these things on their websites. St. Mark's Church in Burlington, back out west, is open from Tuesday, 3 to 7. And Wakefield has a great pantry as well, open on Tuesday and Thursday, both in the morning and in the evening. You can reach them at 781-245-2520. So the bottom line is that there are a lot of places that you can go to provide provide food and to support this work. And there's a lot of people who need help. I would suspect, just based on the numbers, that most food there's more food needed in Lynn, Salem, and Beverly than in Marblehead. So I think that would probably be what I would recommend if you're in Marblehead and have some food to donate. Just drive up to Beverly or right over to Salem and hand it into the pantries there. But if there's a Marblehead food pantry, we'll make sure we get it on the website so you're aware of that as well. Look, there's a lot of work that we need to do here, and there's a long way that we need to do, that we need to go to meet the demands of this crisis. And I want to thank everybody for joining me today and taking part in this town hall. I think town halls are incredibly important. We have a strong record of doing them on this team. I'm sorry that you can hear typing in the background. I don't know where that's coming from, but I apologize for that. We have a strong record of doing of town halls on this team. In fact, in my freshman year, we held more town halls than any other Democrat in Congress, House, or Senate. And we're keeping up that tradition. Not only through the town halls we've already held across the district before this pandemic started, but by making sure we're doing events like this online. In fact, I gave my team, I said to my team, I want to do two town halls every week at a minimum, two town halls every single week. This is our third one this week, a telephone town hall. We had a Facebook Live event with Enes Kanter of the Boston Celtics last night. We did a town hall with an Eagle Scout from Marblehead on Wednesday, and it was on mental health, which was really extraordinary because so many folks are struggling with mental health as everyone feels lonely and disconnected during this pandemic, and that's just this past week. So we're going to keep that up. So please do keep in touch. Keep in touch by social media, Facebook, Twitter, whatever you like to use to follow me and the work that my team is doing. And please make sure you go to our website, moulton.house.gov, and sign up for our newsletter so that you can get these weekly email updates that provide so much good information. A few people on the call have already referenced them. We're going to keep those going out. In fact, there's one that's going out right now. You should be getting it within the next few hours if you haven't received it already. We're going to provide these updates every single week to give you honest, forthright information about exactly what's going on. We're going to get through this, everybody. We're going to get through this as a country. I feel confident we'll emerge wounded but stronger. We can learn from this. We can build for the future, and we can make sure that we're prepared for a pandemic like this if it ever happens again. We got a long way to go, though. And I want to be honest with people about that as well. The president's calls to reopen the country in early May are not realistic. We can perhaps start if we're well prepared, but here we are already halfway through April, and we're clearly not well prepared as we don't even have enough testing to go around. So there's a lot more work to do, and I'm working for you every single day. My team and I are working as hard as we've ever worked, even though we're working remotely, and you can contact us and reach us if you have any problems. So don't be afraid to keep in touch. Tell us what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong. Share your suggestions, your ideas, even your compliments. We want to hear from you because we can't do our jobs. I cannot do my job as your representative if I do not hear from you. I'm very proud to have this job, and I'm proud to represent all of you in Washington. And I know that together we can get through this pandemic. So thanks again for joining me today, and keep in touch.